Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I found a book so haunting and so original that I can't wait to tell my listeners about it. In my case, this book, by my guest, Ann Carson, who is a poet, this book was also useful to me so that anyone who asks, what is the use of poetry, will have that question answered in the course of this show. The book is called Knox. It is an extraordinarily special book. With us is Robert Curry, who has worked with Anne in designing this book, and he is her randomizer in the sense that he has taken texts and brought them into other forms, dance and light and projection, and in this case, a text that was a notebook about the death of a brother. The brother's name is Michael, and Anne did grief work. Michael had run away in, when was it, Anne?
1978.
And after years of only hearing from him in brief letters and postcards, she heard in the year 2000 that he had died. But she heard about it 2 weeks after the death. Why was that?
Well, he himself telephoned me out of the blue in the year 2000 after years of silence and being gone. And we spoke then and made an arrangement to meet. He turned out to be living in Copenhagen. So I then bought a ticket to Copenhagen and was planning to go some weeks hence. And the few days before that departure, his widow phoned me and said he had just died, so I never got to see him again. I did go to Copenhagen and meet the widow, but he wasn't there anymore.
So you had not seen him in over 20 years.
Yes, right, 22 years.
And this work was done as a sort of grief work, yes?
Yeah, I called it an epitaph, and it was a way of understanding, because he left so many mysteries behind about who he was and why he'd made the choices he made, and meeting his widow only intensified that puzzle. So I wanted to think into it somehow, and I found that making the book was a way to not exactly reconstruct him, but just sort of voyage around in him and see what I had ever had as a brother.
And the book then has in it family pictures, notes, stamps from letters that came.
Yeah.
Every way in which the making of such an object can be imagined is contained in the book. So the book becomes, in a sense, a kind of nest. And on one page, there's a nest made with the picture of an egg, with feathers, with bits of text.
Yeah.
When I opened the box in which this book comes, would you describe it, in fact, Robert Curry, who is the inventor of its embodiment as a text for others?
He figured out how to do that.
Well, we'd got the book back from a publisher who'd had it for a couple of years, and when I first saw it, I thought it was such a lovely book, as you've been saying, that there has to be a way. It was a one-off book with lots of things stapled in it and photographs. And we thought there has to be a way to recreate this and somehow recreate the intimacy of that, of reading the original book. So we messed around for a long time, you know, two books, placing pages together, you know, different approaches, all of which would be too expensive or too difficult to handle. We were in Berlin, weren't we?
Yes.
And we were in Berlin, and there was a copy machine in the basement. So I went down and just started making copies of it to see how you could make the page look different with different contrast and stuff. And we realized, and then I started taping the pages together and realized, well, this is the way it could work. It would be just an accordion book with kind of dirty pages, something that gave decay an entrance to the page. And then we thought, ah, what are we going to do now? And then we thought, we have to put it in a box. So everything just kind of followed from there. And when I took it to Declan at New Directions, we were able to design also an oyster box, a box that kind of opens and offers two sides, two containers. So you can move the pages back and forth. And I think they did a lovely job.
Declan is Declan Spring, the editor at, yes, New Directions, who was working with the book. It's extraordinary because then when I was meeting with people at New Directions, they gave me an early copy of the book. And for me, it really solved an enormous problem. Since my father's death, which somehow I hadn't been able to recover from,
yeah,
people had been giving me books with titles like In the Midst of Winter, Poems About Grief.
Yeah.
And,
doesn't,
well,
work.
Yeah, it didn't work. I went for a full year early in the morning to services to say Kaddish for him, mm-hmm, every morning. Something unresolved. When I saw this book, which presents itself as a project.
Yes.
What do we have that remains? How can we respond to it? How can we bring ourselves to it? And I started my own grief project.
Oh, you
once
did?
I saw the book.
No kidding.
And yeah, and it's an unbelievable experience because,
yes,
looking at your book, this book is called Nox, which means
night.
And in this book, what Anne Carson does is to resurrect a long-intended project to translate a poem by the Latin poet Catullus, mm-hmm, about the death of his brother. Which poem is that poem?
It's 101.
101, which she'd first read in her high school Latin class.
Yes.
Now, you say that Catullus is very hard to translate and that you tried it several times. Why is it so hard?
I tried it hundreds of times, I think, that poem over the years. I think it's because he's the first poet. He's the inventor of lyric poetry for the Romans, and he took over methods and meters of Sappho, but he does it in a relatively idiomatic language. It's like Roman street talk, and he somehow mixes that level of language with the, I don't know, the dignity, almost the majesty of elegiac form in verse. And it's just not something English can do. At least I can't do it in English.
Well, you say also that no matter how mournful he becomes,
mm-hmm,
there's something festive.
Yeah, something festive.
About the verse as well. Can you give the description you give. It's so beautiful.
Oh, it seemed to me like those kind of trees that turn all their leaves over in the wind and they're suddenly silver. Going back to grief work, as you said, the project of it, there is a real joy in it, in the making, however mournful the subject matter. I made it my task on each page to try to do something I didn't know how to do. with either the imagery or the text or the staples or the paint or whatever was on the page, so that nothing repeated. I didn't use a method on one page and then say, oh, that looks neat, I'll do it again on five more pages. I abandoned each page and started again to think about how to make a page each time. And that's what made the process salvific. That's why it's a work, working through grief and out the end, because it keeps on instructing the maker that you can start again. You can, you know, live here on this page. The last page died. This one's alive. Let's do it anew. And that's something that's also in the way Catullus writes. There's a kind of joyfulness of inventing again and again on each page a new way of doing the same old thing.
Wow. I'm talking with Anne Carson about her book, Knox. It is a grief work about the death of a brother who had fled home. He had been arrested for drug dealing and had left in order to avoid jail.
Right.
By the time they saw each other again, he was dead. Let's explore the Latin lexical entries by first asking you to read the translation of Catullus that,
okay,
in a way starts the book. The first page of the book is the Catullus poem in Latin.
Catullus 101. Many the peoples, many the oceans I crossed. I arrive at these poor brother burials, so I could give you the last gift owed to death and talk, why, with mute ash. Now that fortune tore you from me, you, oh, poor, wrongly, brother, wrongly taken from me, now still anyway this, what a distant mood of parents handed down as the sad gift for burials, accept, soaked with tears of a brother, and into forever, brother, farewell and farewell.
It's beautiful. Can you read it in Latin?
I
think this will be the only radio show in America in which you will hear a poem in Latin and English.
Okay. C.I. Multas per gentes et multa per aequor vectus. Adveniós miseros frater ad inferios, ut te postremo donarem munera mortis, et mutam nequic qualoquerer cinerem. Quando quidem fortuna mihi te abstulit ipsum, hu miser indigna frater ad empta mihi. Nunc tamen interiaic prisco quae more parentum, tradita sunt tristi munera ad inferios. Acipa fraterno multum manantia fletu, at quin perpetuum frater au atqua vale.
Now, the book then takes the Latin poem word by word and gives us definitions of each word. Where do these definitions come from?
They're from the Oxford Latin Lexicon, a little bit manipulated by me. In general, I give the whole entry of the lexicon for that word, but as I was reading the words, I mean, it's the initial exercise you perform when you're translating is to look up every word, and reading through the whole entry for the meaning of the word gives you ideas about how to translate that you wouldn't have before you looked at it. And as I was doing that, I came upon examples, idiomatic examples in the lexical entries having to do with night, and they kind of accumulated in my mind. And then I began to manipulate the entries a little bit to include more examples of night, and then that became a kind of gathering point for the ideas on that side of the page in the book.
Well, what was wonderful is that at first as you're reading the entries, and there's a meditation on the word entry later on in the book.
Yes.
You begin to think, huh, this knocks, this night is recurring, and I hadn't noticed it at first, and could it be that every word in the Latin lexicon will bring a reference to night with it? And then you realize that it's part of the form of grief that brings the subject up wherever you look.
Yeah, exactly. And also in his case, since he was always a kind of vanishing person, it was there anyway. He was always going into shadow in my experience and my understanding of him. So it came out from all sides of the story of who he was.
Now, that shadow place seems crucially to be a memory of a stairwell.
Hmm.
He's come home with his nose bloodied.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. I guess that is where the shadow metaphor starts. Yeah, that day, I think he was about 9, perhaps. It was a Sunday. Remember one of those endless Sundays you have? I would have been 5. And he came in, and he was in the stairwell, and he had a bloody nose. And it was just somehow typical of his experience to be always coming home wrecked. And my mother frantic, and no explanation. I never knew why, but he always had that going out as an adventurer to conquer and reconquer the world and coming home wrecked.
And there's later a fragment of memory conversation from mother. Oh no, what this time? You know,
yes.
that sense of a woman captured in very few words who's been overwhelmed by raising children. And, you know, how do I handle this now?
Yeah, I think it was for her just another example of the same thing, and she never knew what to do. You couldn't change him. He kept on wanting to voyage out and make friends with people who would beat him up.
How many pictures in this book does he have a broken arm?
That's another thing I noticed after I made the book, that he's always appearing with a broken limb or a bandage in these photos. And at the time in the family, we didn't really remark on it, but that was his heroic nature. Go out and get broken, come back.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ann Carson, author of Knox, this extraordinary book which helped find its embodiment, not only through its publisher, New Directions, but particularly through Robert Curry, the randomizer. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ann Carson about Knox. And the true subject is, you know, here is a poem of grief by Catullus being translated and put step by step into a notebook as translated, as worded.
Mm-hmm.
The process seems to be a process that's very strange, because we know that when a poem is finally translated, it's become something else and can't be itself, just as grief, when translated, becomes inevitably altered.
Yes. And it has a kind of time in it that's irrecoverable. I mean, a translation ages with you, as it were. And I, as I say, tried to translate this same text over and over again, so it was layers and layers of myself that I kept finding when I looked up the words and remembered all the processes of thought I had gone through to figure out how to say that word in this language, English, from that language, Latin. And it kind of seemed analogous to the process of going back over and over another person and trying to pull out a memory here and a memory there and a layer of understanding here and make it into something you could call a translation.
Well, it's so interesting. I don't know whether I was being just copycat with
your project?
My project about my father, which I started because of seeing Anne's book. It suddenly made me understand, in the same way that Donald Barthelme used to tell his students to build altars the things they loved. Finally I had something to do with my hands and my mind to make grief transform into something else. So I thank you for the process. But immediately I started working with the Hebrew alphabet, which I both know and don't know.
Yes.
And was much more familiar to my father in a way. But it's almost as if to work from an unknown language.
Yes.
Which you kind of pretend is the language of death or the unknown or the ancient.
Something like that, yeah. There is that kind of haunting possibility under all our language of the other language that it came from that's truer somehow, is more originary, more down in the roots of the meanings of things.
Now, at some point, right, the healing work is working in a way because you're not thinking so much of the death, but of the form of the book.
Yes.
What the book needs.
Exactly. And what order can rise out of it. Because I think that's the first experience for a long time of grief, is that it's chaos. There's no map. You bump into it everywhere you go. It's always seeping up through things. And the effort of making a book out of it is gradually a process of seeing, what do I have here in the way of raw materials? How can I make it into a thing that's got a beginning, middle, and end, and will seem beautiful or pleasurable to somebody else to look at? And that takes you beyond the grief, because you're making something already that is ordered and that is to be given to somebody further.
I thought you did actually make it this sort of thing of, it starts with seeing grief. That's always the way I thought about the book.
Autopsy.
Yeah. So you're actually seeing the grief for the first time. In this.
You, the reader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Curry seems to have entered your life as through collaboration.
That's true, I guess. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
That's kind of
amazing.
Well, we think together. I don't know. Yeah, we think together. I mean, we think two halves of one thought without competing, which is unusual, I think, for any two people.
I've never made a perfect page in my life, so
and
I leave that to Anne.
His thought is spatial. Mine is all about pages, but his is spatial and three-dimensional, I would say, or more than three-dimensional. So we can come together on a thought, and his way of looking at it makes it more, not just different.
And I think if grief, or at least my experience, seems to function by separating you from every other thing, disconnection of a previously unexperienced and I think unanticipatable sort. It seems moving to me that ultimately the movement out of grief connects you with another.
Yeah, that's true, because it didn't begin to seem possible actually to publish it till I showed it to you.
The the first time I read it. It was such an extraordinary book and such a lovely object that there had to be a way.
Yeah, I don't have that had to be level of mind. It's a mechanical thing, I guess.
Well, we've been talking about Knox, which is, you know, an extraordinary thing to be talking about at this time when so many people are talking about the future of the book and whether books have a future, to find one that alters the nature of the book.
And can't be read on Kindle.
Will never be read on Kindle because its processes are intimately bound, to use that specific word, with the process of grief, grieving, collecting, translating, making, shaping. And so here we have a huge strip, accordion pleated, that could be used as a frieze hung across the top of the wall, just near the ceiling.
It,
you can hear it flutter in the microphone wind.
That sounds good.
It really does sound very nice.
That's them. That's those people at New Directions.
It's an absolutely great pleasure to be able to bring this book to others who may themselves find, through a process of grief, that they need a process of creation that will in some way demobilize or diminish or gradually
make it festive,
transform into festivity.
I hope so.
I hope so. It's been a real pleasure to talk to both of you.
Oh, you too.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Well.
I've been talking with Ann Carson, author most recently of Knox, and Robert Curry, the designer randomizer of the project, which is published by New Directions. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojcik and Noriko Okabe at the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
To the land of ice and snow in book. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.